In the late 90s, Harvard Business School professor Amy Edmondson conducted a study to understand the relationship between team dynamics and error rate in hospitals. She anticipated that the most effective teams, those with strong collaboration among doctors and nurses, would report fewer mistakes. Surprisingly, her findings revealed the opposite. The best teams actually reported more errors. This wasn't because they made more mistakes, but because they felt psychologically safe to acknowledge and discuss them. In environments where team members could openly address errors without the fear of blame, they were able to learn from these mistakes, leading to improved processes and patient care. This pivotal research highlights the critical role of a zero-blame culture in fostering learning and growth through intelligent failures. We will dive into this topic today with my guest, Alexandra Grichin, who is an ICG consultant, trainer, coach, and psychotherapist. Alexandra is specialized in leadership, organizational development, and workplace well-being, making her one of my top choices for today's topic, diagnosing and helping organizations transition from a blame culture to one that is collaborative and adaptive requires a multidisciplinary approach.
Welcome to Change That Works, a podcast by ICG about change, leadership, and innovation that takes you behind the scenes. Today's host will be Alexandra Popescu-Zorica.
Hi, Alexandra, and welcome to our podcast today.
Hi, Alexandra. Good to be here.
It's going to be a very simple conversation, Alexandra. Very easy for people to follow us in our discussion. I'm really excited that we made it to our episode and we are discussing a topic that it's so important, I would say, for organizations today. The idea of a zero blame culture and the intelligent failures that we will address later. Now, I would like to start by asking you, what is a zero blame culture and why is it so important to discuss it today in the organizations?
I would say that the zero blame culture is a concept built around the positive belief that each employee wants to do their job to the best of their ability. And when problems arise, it's not because of employees' laziness or lack of willingness, but rather about inappropriate adjustments of the system or the processes. So we are actually looking at a systematic problem and not just the one error that happens. And in a way, it's a subjective assessment of behavior. Problem solving is based on facts and figures and is illustrating the reality rather than opinions or finger pointing or just trying to cover up your tail. So this is where I think we can start talking about the zero blame culture. And of course, it's really important in organizations where you want to build psychological safety. So for people to feel at ease when they address any ideas or questions that are about the work content and also including errors or failure in the processes. So we really need this kind of culture when we talk about learning organizations and continuous improvement.
You know, in the beginning, I was telling the story about the research of Amy Edmondson and the surprising finding that, yes, actually teams where there is a good psychological safety are teams that do report more errors because they feel safe to talk about it. So there isn't such thing as no errors or teams without mistakes. That's maybe something that we experienced, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, going into a company, into a team. This is the team that does everything perfectly. There's no such thing. We all make mistakes. It's important how we deal with them, like you said. And so coming back to what you said, building this zero blame culture comes from the fact that people are willing to acknowledge that we are making mistakes. And probably in this fast changing environment, we are going to make more and more mistakes in the workplace. And we are safe to discuss about it, but most importantly, to learn from it. And we are both passionate about Amy and her research. And we discussed a bit about the difference between making a mistake and failures and intelligent failures. Would you dive a bit into that to explain to people listening to us? What's the thing with mistakes and failures and intelligent failures?
Yes, Amy Edmondson did her PhD on learning from failure, or actually in the beginning it was about successful teams. And this is what she uncovered, that actually performing teams not necessarily that they make or they do more mistakes, but rather that they report them. And in this way, the company actually can protect itself from even bigger issues, because the people who are making the mistakes are reporting themselves and trying to figure out what allowed the mistake to happen, and then how can they improve the system and the processes as well. So she starts putting these mistakes and failure into categories, and she says that not all failures are the same or they are not equal. Some mistakes are maybe stupid mistakes or very basic mistakes where you know what you should be doing, you know what the process is, but you fail. And here we can talk about deviance, where maybe in some processes, somebody intentionally does something to avoid maybe a process step or to improve quality in an unfair way. Or it can be about inattention or even lack of ability in some cases. But also there are more complex failures where you plan, you do the research, you have some hypotheses that you're testing, and then you do the experiments to the best of your ability, and it becomes a failure. So in these cases, she refers to complex failures and then to intelligent failures, where you can actually learn something about it and you can explore maybe a new field or a new topic where there is not so much knowledge. So you can really learn from failure. And she also talks about these 9 levels of failure, from deviance, inattention, and then moving on to task challenges, uncertainty, and the best kind of failures, the intelligent ones, which are experimentation and exploration. And this really helps organizations to really look into what part of the system should we address. What are the process steps that are not yet fail-proof or that are even inadequate or faulty in that sense? So yeah, this is how we now look at failures. And for me, it's even more important when I do trainings, because in the training room, we want people to leave with new ideas, with some new questions maybe. And for this to happen, we really need a culture where it's safe to fail. It's safe to ask stupid questions. It's safe to answer in a maybe old way or in ways that really can challenge your beliefs.
This triggers 2 questions in my mind. One is related to leadership area. So I know that it's very difficult to have such an environment without the support of the leaders. And it is important that leaders initiate this movement where we, let's say, celebrate these failures by learning from them. We turn them into something intelligent, something useful for the organization. So this is one thing that we would like to touch upon. What can leaders do about that? And the second question that triggered my mind was related to people, to employees, us accepting failure, because we like to succeed. So maybe failure is not part of our mental map of being a successful person, you know? And how do you address those 2? So on one hand, working with the leaders, and what is it that they can do about it? And then how can you help employees acknowledge that, in a way, failures, intelligent failures, are actually good for their development and for the organization?
Leaders can start by modeling a way to deal with failure. I would say that this is the most important part of leadership when we work in big organizations, that they have this ability and also the influence to show how to deal with failure. How can I show my vulnerability and the errors that I made, and how to learn from that, not just to find the guilty one and to finger point and say that you solved the issue, but rather how do you look at failures in a solution-oriented way? And I think this is where leaders can start, by acknowledging their own vulnerability and taking accountability on the shortcomings that they might have, because leaders are also not perfect in any way. And on the other hand, when we talk about perfectionism, maybe what leaders can do is to be open when people are coming to them with feedback about failure, with information about possible errors that they have made, and not to have these really big walls and high standards where people feel like they will be judged or punished, or that there's this black book that they keep the whole year and that they will be punished in the performance review, for example. So rather to discuss openly with employees, allow this kind of discussions, this would be really important in organization. And then, of course, they can empower different processes where you can learn from mistakes, and it's a continuous learning process, continuous development, rather than going with 5 steps to success or bulletproof procedures that you cannot touch. So from the other point of view, so if we look, we might say bottom up. So what can you do as part of an organization, as part of a team, when you don't have that kind of influence that the leader has? It's really important to be aware of yourself. And when you have the tendency to cover your tail or to finger point or even to hide when there are risks to be taken, and to protect yourself by choosing the safest option. So when you are aware of these situations, then you can start by also trying out yourself. What are the limits? How can I make sure that this failure that I'm about to do could be an intelligent failure, and I do my best to learn something from it? And also the way that we communicate with our colleagues, it's important that we keep an open mind and be curious about how did they come to that situation and what allowed from the system and the process point of view for the failure to happen, and not to just say you are solving it because you found the first one who did the mistake and then everything else went wrong.
You talk a lot about systems and process. What from the system or from the process allowed that mistake to happen? And I find it very valuable that we are not finger pointing to people. So it's not about who did that or who was the person that allowed for the mistake to happen, but rather what in the way that we are organized allowed that to happen. And I wanted to point that out for our listeners, because this is a very important difference that we find in companies that are oriented to experimentation and exploration. It's not finger pointing to a person, making a person responsible, but rather finding out what's happening in the system, in the process that allowed for that to happen. Of course, people are responsible and accountable for their work, but it's in a positive and empowering way. And I want to ask you about maybe a case or a company where you've discussed, implemented, maybe trained people on a zero blame culture. But before I do that, I just want to share a small example also from something that you mentioned earlier. You know, part of my professional work, I collaborated with some startups and also had the opportunity to see how other startups are organized from within. And there was this startup that I really appreciated for their growth appetite. It's actually from Timișoara and was recently acquired. It's about Taz. And the leadership team there had these objectives for people to make really bold moves. So it wasn't about mistakes, but if they were punishing something, to say like punishing, it was rather making very small safe moves. They were not about that. They wanted people and really encouraged people to take bold moves and to try audacious things like no one has ever thought about. That was rewarded. And with that, a lot of failures and mistakes came. But that was the most important thing for the company, to make bold moves rather than be safe. And maybe starting from that, if you have an example to share with us in your work on the zero blame culture.
I think in organizational development, we see a lot of good examples like this one. Even Google has this kind of culture, or Netflix and so on. We actually can learn a lot about their examples and the way that they are implementing zero blame culture and psychological safety. We actually do have a recent example where we worked with an organization, and it's still an ongoing process, so I'm not going to say any names about the company, but we did work with a few of their management teams. So it's an automotive company, and they have a few production sites in Romania, also an R&D center. And the challenge with them was, how might we support the leaders, the top management of the company, to talk about failure with one another first of all, and also to bring that conversation back to their organizations and make it more accessible in a healthy way. So this was the challenge that came from them. They started already having this kind of zero blame culture workshops and implementing it in the feedback processes and so on. But then it was about how do we bring this back to the organization? So we came up with the zero blame game, where we would invite them to talk about failure, first of all, as hypothetical situations, hypothetical failures that can happen in automotive industry, because it's an industry that has really high quality standards. So it was a really good place to start. And then we would ask them to use this failure scale that I was saying about earlier from Amy Edmondson and try to figure out what kind of failure they were looking at. And it's a 9-level or 9-step scale for the spectrum of reasons of failure. And they were pretty surprised to learn that many of their failures were not so much on first and second levels, so deviant behavior or inattention, but rather something about task challenge or the process inadequacy or even process complexity or uncertainty. So this was the main learning that they had at the end of this. And another insight, very interesting, was that they found out they are not doing a lot of experimentation and exploration kind of work. So failures in this area were rather few. And it was interesting for them to think about what kind of risks are we taking and why aren't our teams taking more risks and exploring more and doing more experimentation rather than trying out the solutions that have already been tested. So this is how we worked with the blame game, and it really encouraged conversations in an authentic and intimate way between managers, senior managers in different factory sites.
Can you run this game with managers and employees also, between employees? How is it?
Yeah, I think that this would be even more interesting to have these conversations inside the team. So you as a manager to work with your team members and address the issues maybe from the last year that you had or from the history of the company and discuss what is the perspective from the employees? What do they see in those kind of failures? How could they have been avoided or what allowed for the failures to happen? I would say it would be even better for leaders to do this at the team level and not just in the management team of a company. And for sure, this was one of our hopes when we did this kind of program, that they will bring the cards, because it's a card game, that they would bring the cards back to their teams and have a way to discuss the failures in a safe way and in a playful way that really activates the free child inside everybody and they are able to learn from their mistakes.
So what I'm hearing from you is that this game could be an excellent conversation starter for leaders in an organization. So say a company wants to start discussing about zero blame culture and failures, mistakes. This would be a great way to start the conversation between the leadership team for them to acknowledge and to self-evaluate their level of responsiveness, openness towards failure. But then people could also take the game and run it themselves with their teams. And that could be like part of a self-diagnosis exercise, opening up vulnerability among leaders and their teams and employees. That would work, right?
Yeah, and I think there is another point to this. When you take it back to your team, it's also a way to show that a zero-blame culture doesn't mean that anything goes. It doesn't mean that only the system is responsible or accountable for mistakes, and that in this way you are able to make a difference between good failure, intelligent failure, and the errors that could have been avoided or that should have been avoided in a clear process. So in this way you can also avoid the risk that people will think there are no more consequences and you can do anything because nobody will blame you for it, and rather to really see where we put the blame and what needs to have really consequences and what not.
Okay, so it can also turn like into a map or maybe a guideline in a way for people to know, okay, this is a mistake. This is a rookie mistake. You shouldn't have done that. Yeah, maybe once, but not twice. But then this is an intelligent failure and this is how it looks and this is why we celebrate it and we learn from it and we embrace it. What happens next? Organizations open up. They say, okay, we need to start this dialogue. They run the game. They start working with it. They acknowledge it. What happens next with an organization that they can truly scale this zero blame culture and see growth and development? Because at the end of the day, most of the things that we do, if not everything that we do in an organization, is because we want to grow, we want to develop it and the people. So how does this impact a business, building the zero blame culture and scaling it?
Well, as we know, the transformation journey that most organizations are starting to embark on in different moments of their development, this also requires a change management process. So after this kind of awareness, you know, building awareness of the employees and the management and about the processes that we have, then you embark on a transformation journey where you have to put things in motion. So what we actually try to do with this organization is to implement this kind of specific actions where, as you said, it's about diagnosing and then about having a way to discuss about failure, to bring them into the practice of everyday work. Of course, it is a learning curve and it's a change curve that we are working with, and there are a lot of resistances because the way that you communicate it in the organization is really important. And I think the best way to do it is an interactive and very practical way. So whenever you have opportunities like failures where you can learn from, to really take them and tackle them in this way, where you make it clear what is the reason for failure? You try to dig deeper for the root cause, for understanding behind the scenes, and then to finding solutions. So don't get stuck in finding the root cause and feel like you solved it, but rather future orientation and solution orientation is actually really, really important whenever you get the opportunity. And it's a process. They can learn from it and see what works for their organization. And I think it depends a lot also on the maturity of the organization and the field. So, for example, I think that in our field as consultants, we tend to be rather mature about failure and making a lot of experiments or even exploratory hypotheses. And we are really happy to learn from our failure. But there are a lot of industries where failure is not that well reflected upon. And for sure, we also would not accept failure in, I don't know, surgery or aviation or stuff like that. So as consumers or clients of different businesses, we do expect that their criteria is really high when it comes to dealing with errors, but at the same time that they are actually open to discuss when failure really happens, because it's inevitable. And when you work in complex and uncertain environment, it's even more so.
Opening up the dialogue, creating awareness, understanding patterns, and then committing to a change process that is going to positively affect the organization in time, up to a point where this organization transforms towards a zero blame one, which actually opens up a lot of opportunities for them to test, to experiment, to become more agile and more responsive to the business environment. This is what I'm taking from you as a roadmap for success for organizations. Of course, that this roadmap depends from one organization to another, how big the organization is, regulated, what is their track record history with failure, experimenting failure, the commitment of the leadership team, and so on. But a very important step is acknowledging the need to start discussing about it and at least self-evaluating ourselves into how responsive we are to failures, how much we encourage that, how we learn from that, and how we create this psychological safety for the people. In our last minute in this episode, Alex, is there a message, an advice that you would give to anybody in an organization that really wants to address this blame game, whether it's an employee, it's the management, it's the leader of the organization? How do you start this conversation? What is your 60-second advice?
If we expect our teams to be open and accountable, we need to model that, how it looks like, with authenticity, vulnerability, and I would say also self-compassion. Everyone, including leaders, or mostly leaders, make mistakes and have to learn from it. So admit your mistakes, seek input and advice from team members, maybe discuss lessons learned from past failures, and show a way to solve them in the future and become more flexible in learning in a complex and uncertain environment. This is where I would start.
Well, thank you, Alexandra, so much for our discussion today.
Thank you also for the invitation. I'm really happy to talk about this topic.
And for our listeners, if they want to find out more about the blame game, about change management, psychological safety, and everything that we do, the work that we do with our customers, we will drop the links in the description of this episode. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Change That Works seeks to inspire a different way to transform organizations. Let's tune in again for our next episode.